You're listening to a stage talk titled Researching Central Asia, Strategic Insights and Defense Data. Michael Hilliard spoke about the release of his new report, The Armed Forces of Central Asia. The report is a valuable resource for researching this region, and we speak about the complex geopolitical landscape in Central Asia, and what capacity the countries have to tackle their strategic challenges. You can find all of the links mentioned in the talk in the description of this podcast. The talk was hosted by me, Mirozu, on Thursday the 24th of October in the Bellingcat Discord server. Hi everyone, good to see you back for this week's Bellingcat Discord stage talk. Today we've invited Michael Hilliard to the stage. He's the Director of Defense and Security Analysis for the Oxus Society of Central Asian Affairs. He's one of the authors of a new report titled The Armed Forces of Central Asia. This is a comprehensive analysis of the military capabilities of five Central Asian countries. It includes an impressive database of detailed military knowledge about the region. But the report goes beyond just examining military hardware. It also gives an insight in strategic challenges and geopolitical characteristics of Central Asia. The chapter they recently released zooms into Tajikistan, a country navigating a particularly complex geopolitical landscape. The state's powerful neighbors, reliance on foreign assistance, and its geography make the country a unique case study for understanding the security challenges and opportunities that are facing this region. I'll first give the stage to Michael so he can present his work and a new report he published. But we'll dive into the Q&A section straight after, so please put all of your questions in the chat when Michael is presenting, and I'll make sure to ask them. If you don't want me to read out your name, please mention this along with your question. All right, Michael, please go ahead and take the stage.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been a long-term fan of Bellingcat, and Bellingcat's OSINT tool has been incredibly helpful throughout this project. So I'm Michael Hilliard. I'm the Director of Defense and Security Analysis, as we just went through. And I've been tearing up the team, effectively putting together a 1,000-page report on the five militaries of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan, mostly because there just hasn't been any really decent studies on the doctrines, the changes, the security services, what's been going on in this region, and is an incredibly interesting microcosm of a whole range of issues, whether it be the flow-on effects in the Russian arms export markets, whether it be the problems with ISK and obviously Islamic State itself, into state rivalries and, different forces structures that effectively mean that we now have, multiple militaries that actually compete against one another inside the country. So the first chapter of this, has dropped just recently alongside a map because we wanted to give back to the OSINT community. Effectively, the analysis work that a lot of people have done, the tools that particularly guys like Bellingcat have put together, have been incredibly helpful throughout this. So by putting out all of the military locations for Tajikistan, effectively it means that anyone who is looking, at a Tajik border incident or looking at what's going on, it might be easier to, shrink it down to what you need to find. So generally we are at a really interesting crossroads for the region. We saw this war in Ukraine kick off, and that obviously, reduced Russia's capacity to intervene as much in the region. Particularly Tajikistan, which still does actually have the largest Russian military presence outside of the Federation, under the banner of the 201st military base. That's shrunk by nearly half. There was about 7,000 Russian personnel sitting inside the country prior to Ukraine. And now it's down to around 3,000. We're also seeing China encroaching a bit more, although China is, taking a very different approach to what Russia is and effectively paying Tajikistan to do their work for them. India has, long tried to get a presence in here and today has a very small presence in the country. France and the United States used to have presences here as well back during the sort of the higher end years of the war on terror. So it's an absolutely fascinating country as a microcosm of the problems. I think, I'll go through some of the real basics for everyone to understand how these militaries work and how odd they are. Because, from a Western perspective, we tend to look at militaries as, the army, the navy, the air force, a very kind of conventional way. But when it comes to a nation like Tajikistan, the structure and the branches are so, you know, disconnected and contradictory that it is really interesting to kind of pull it all together. Now, I do have some charts, which I can pull up if need be, but I'll kind of talk the very basics through it. So just as an idea of how these militaries function for everyone listening as well, you know, we have a system where effectively you have a National Guard, which is an entirely separate branch to every other part of the military. You have your standard kind of ground forces, air and air defense forces, which are put together, our mobile forces, effectively being almost a paratrooper group, similar to what the Russian watchers will call the VDV, which are all under the Ministry of Defense, which sounds like a very conventional forces. Whereas you have internal troops as well, which is an army to effectively monitor things inside the country, do riot suppression, keep the regime in power. And then on top of that, you have the border service, which is under the command of the State Committee for National Security, which I guess, for lack of a better word, you'd call the Tajik KGB. What was really interesting about Tajikistan is how disconnected these guys are. So the border service, which is quite a common structure for the rest of the region as well, only answers to the security services, to the FSB, what is the equivalent of the FSB, which only answers to the president. And it's why in Tajikistan you see this very odd system where the ground forces are not designed to fight wars. They're very poorly armed and they're very poorly trained. The mobile forces are a really good rapid reaction force, probably some of the best in Central Asia. But the border service are really poorly armed, but at the same time, the most sought after positions in the Tajik military, because people have been able to, you know, they join the border service. People actually, multiple households, we get reports of them pooling their money together to try and get their child in the border service so they can be on the Afghan border and control the flow of heroin into the country. Because you can earn so much more as, you know, taking bribes, doing that, than you can as a conventional soldier. You know, it can be the difference between, you know, $190 to $120 a month for what your conventional pay is versus pulling in, you know, $500 to $2,000 a month if you're willing to be on the border service taking in drugs. But it's also the border service, because of how disconnected they are, that unlike, let's say, the you know, the mobile forces or the ground forces, which have to talk to their commanders, they can't just fire on people. Border services are allowed to shoot back. You know, it makes sense. They're usually deployed in the middle of nowhere. If you look at our maps, a lot of their bases are very, very small and right on the edge of the country. But now you have a problem of a force that is disconnected from everywhere else and is only going to stay that way because they're financially incentivized to. And is the one that can fire upon everyone with no questions asked. And now you have Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan who all have those same forces. And this is what brought up the problems in 2022, where we had a skirmish. We have kind of a series of skirmishes that were really small, but a big one in 2022 around Batken, where effectively Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan got into a conflict with one another. Many people died. It wasn't great. Lasted a few days. But the border service of both sides are so disconnected from the rest of the military that the rest of the military learned from what was going on mostly via social media. So you have border services which are operating completely independently, drawing the country into war, which is, again, almost not a unique thing to Central Asia, but definitely complicates the entire system of what we have going on here. The other one is just seeing how Russia is trying to, you know, probably gain back some of its ground it lost during the sort of 2022-2023 period, particularly at the very start of the war when they realized that this is not going to be a three-day operation like they planned. Now there's nowhere near enough equipment to get back on the market. Effectively now, rather than exporting to these countries as usual, they had to desperately divert it toward the Russian war effort. Now that's starting to creep back, but across that period, we did see some of these Central Asians go look elsewhere for other arms distributors, other arms partners, people, places to go. And Russia is now, you know, its production capacity has reached a point where it can, you know, effectively fill the export market and the domestic demand. And now we're not seeing everything snap back to where it was beforehand. So this is a big change period for all five of the republics. And yet it's so little watch because defense companies who usually pay for these kind of studies don't actually have anything to sell in this region. Most of the stuff is manufactured in the 1960s and 70s. Not many people understand it. They're very insular. They're very, very small. Their military budgets are quite small. But yeah, it's an incredibly interesting region that is still even though we are seeing a cultural shift away from Russia, you know, it's been only in the last couple of years that when I travel to these countries, I'm starting to get pushback on from particularly younger citizens saying, no, we don't speak Russian here. We speak Uzbek. And I go, okay, well, you know, I don't speak Uzbek. I'm really sorry. That's a very new thing for this region. So there's a cultural shift happening, but the security services are still very much tied to Russia, very aligned with Russia, and Russia still has massive influence in the defense and security sector here. It's a fascinating region that the more you peel back, the weirder it gets. It's the best way I could put it. But I'll hand over to Q&A, and I'm sure there'll be lots of questions on everything from Russia to China to, you know, why these guys are using tanks that were made in the 1960s.
Hi, thank you for this great introduction to the research you did. The report is very impressive, and I definitely recommend people to check it out. I would like to open with, you mentioned that open source research played quite a critical role in making this report. Could you elaborate a bit on the specific processes or like methodologies and resources you used in the process of writing this report?
So a lot of it is trying to find out, for instance, where bases are located, how much personnel they've got, what condition their gear is in. Some of that will be effectively just trolling, you know, war reports. Some will be just going through news reports. Quite often, you know, you might have a president, Rahmon, went out to visit unit 13403 this afternoon, and he said this. Others will be, you know, finding videos that have been recorded by family members at parades, and, you know, the family, or my daughter who's in 1303, or my son, sorry, has been 1303, is at this parade, and you can start to geolocate it. You're having the tools to Bellingcat just, you know, shrinks down what you're effectively looking for and gives you a good clue on the kind of things you're looking for. Others are just terrible operational security. So as part of this project, to try and find where units are moving in real time, or, you know, what unit this might be, you know, we made a whole buttload of Facebook fake profiles and VK profiles, and you know, hung out in sort of groups or, you know, places that we knew that some of these guys would hang out, like, you know, group chats for unit XYZ, and effectively would find people, start making spreadsheets and seeing what other social media they have linked to it. And then we can find things like trying to track down Russian missile operators that we know this, you know, this unit has these missiles. We don't know where they're going to be based, but finding one of their recruits having a public Snapchat with his real-time location up was very useful. So we can just pop open the Snapchat and see his little avatar exactly where we expect him to be. You know, also just finding people we can speak to and talk to, and this was really useful to get, you know, of getting defectors to send us information, or being able to just bribe people, or getting whatever we need out of it was really quite crucial to get a hold of government documents, because there's not a lot of public work that's been done on this region. So it was quite a bit of a challenge to try and get everything pulled together. But finding the most obscure videos to find geolocations for some of this stuff was a lot of just watching some terrible, terrible Tajik YouTube stuff. When I close my eyes, all I see is Tajik music videos now.
I think that sounds familiar for many Bellingcat researchers and people in the server. I have a question from Subtle Knife, a question I find very creative. And I'm assuming this is about the region of Central Asia, but you can answer it however you like. But if you were invisible or had the perfect hat for a disguise, and you could take a look anywhere without getting caught, where would you go?
Oh, that's a very good question. So for anyone who might know me from either this, or I also host the podcast, the Redline podcast, I collect hats wherever I go in the region. I have a giant shelf of hats in my house from all over the place in countries I've reported for or been in over the years. If I was to go anywhere, I would probably have a nice, you know, Russian officer's hat and try and sit within the Russian bases, particularly the 201st and the CSTO bases in the region. You know, effectively, Russia has three very large facilities in Tajikistan, the big one being, four actually, sorry. They've got the massive facility in Dushanbe right in the capital, which means effectively the strongest military force in the capital is the Russians, just like the Russians the strongest air force in Kyrgyzstan. They have another base down in Bokhtar, which is tied to the 201st, but actually it's just the 191st regiment down there. And they have Aini Air Base, which the Russians were, you know, pretty annoying to the Indians. Effectively, the Indians helped refurbish the base and get it back up from where it was, an old Soviet leftover. The Indians put a lot of money into it, rebuilt it. It was going to be a joint Indian-Tajik base, and then the Russians convinced the Tajiks to kick the Indians out and back down to a tiny unused airfield near the Afghan border. They now operate jointly out of Aini, which is to the west of the city. And they also have a very large missile battery in the west of the country as well. In fact, S-300s, which is far above what most of the Central Asian militaries have, which is kind of this dynamic we see where most of the Central Asian military kit is pretty old, pretty degraded, not great. And the Russians obviously, for the most time, actually have better equipment than the local forces do. Even just little things like when we are doing, you know, the wargaming with a few organizations and trying to stress test this and see where the problems are. You know, the Russian operators quite often have, you know, independent communication systems, whereas the local internal forces quite often don't. So if you take the communications towers out, or you shut the telecoms off, or shut the power off, it becomes really hard for local forces to communicate, but quite easy for the Russians to do so. If I was to go anywhere, I'd love to be inside the 201st. I think that would be fascinating to see what the Russians were keeping their eyes on, whether they are, as they say, primarily focused on, you know, the Afghan border, making sure, you know, problems don't come up from there, or whether they are more worried about the internal stability of the regime and the government in Dushanbe. That would definitely be my, if I were invisible. That, or I just, you know, eat all of the Tajik food I could without having to be shameful about how much Tajik food I've eaten.
Everyone in the audience, please put your questions for Michael in the chat. And I'm going to go continue to Sam's question, who asks, did you have any chances to use the new Bellingcat geolocation tool, or maybe generally any Bellingcat tools in your research?
OSM has been incredibly helpful. It's very useful for kind of limiting down what you want to be looking for, or even just getting a general sense of things. Also finding, you know, when you have a town, you might, let's say, you know, you've seen from a news report that you know that unit, take the argument, 30630 with a Russian designation. You know, we know it's in Bartkin somewhere. We know it's, you know, a battalion, because that we've seen that from news reports. Okay, we now have seen this, you know, military exercise or people walking through the town. You know, Bellingcat's tool of being able to effectively, you know, geolocate that crossing walk, or geolocate that the base, or, you know, get an idea of where this might be or where it might be in the region has been incredibly helpful, because you could, you know, you can never just completely trust that to be 100%, but it does help add up enough or add to the sort of the credibility of that. My personal technique for this is to kind of, you know, I want to get to a kind of a 10 or a 14, you know, for, again, numbers are whatever you want to set it at, but, you know, if I can find a government document with it, automatic sort of 8 points to it. But if I get government document and, you know, using the Bellingcat tool, I can find a news report that has an exercise that I can see was done in front of that facility, that's probably enough for me. That's a 8 and a 6. Whereas, you know, if it's just a bunch of Twitter posts, then maybe it's a lot of ones, but a lot of ones can eventually add up. But yeah, it's been really helpful to have these tools. And, you know, even before this project, you know, having all this stuff available on Bellingcat stuff has been incredibly helpful. So hence why very much hope was happy to do this and offer whatever we can back to you guys.
And Giancarlo is asking, what advice do you have for people looking to get into your field?
be prepared to drink a lot. it really depends. You know, it's, I highly recommend, you know, I do tell people to study a lot of finance, economics. You know, obviously spend some time in the region, get to know your local contacts, you know, be able to look at things from both kind of a 6 foot view, I mean, you know, what on the ground, understand what's going on, you know, be willing to go out to these countries and talk to people and go, hey, look, why would you want to join the border service? Oh, well, because I can earn a lot more money. And that kind of gives you a clue of what's going on behind the scenes. But also being able to look at the, you know, the widespread economics of it and look at the, let's say, the production numbers from Russian armaments, and then kind of look at the price on the open market for some of these and go, okay, well, you know, we expect the price to go up by this much and then come down by this much. And that would probably put the, you know, we would expect that the Tajiks would probably return to buying Russian armaments by this point. Yeah, having a few different skills, I think is really, really important in this field. Not just, you know, OSINT is an amazing skill to have, and it's one that everyone's screaming out for at the moment. But having OSINT plus a bit of finance, or OSINT plus a bit of economics, or OSINT plus a bit of language skills is a huge, huge plus for anyone hoping to sort of get into this.
Thank you. That's great advice. Moving on to the next question. Does the government there in Tajikistan play an active role in the drug trafficking through its border? And how important is India's role in the region? I guess these are two separate questions.
Both great questions, though. The government very much does have an active role in the drug trafficking. And it's been really interesting to see the kind of changes that have happened. So effectively, what the system is now is the heroin will come up from Afghanistan, and it will have to cross somewhere into Central Asia. Once it's in Central Asia, it becomes easier to get out to the Chinese, the European, and the Russian market. Turkmenistan's really difficult to get into. And even if you can get through Sahatabad and pass the massive border patrol forces there, you're going to have to walk thousands of kilometers through the desert. So it's not a great option. You don't want to come across into Uzbekistan. The border is quite short, and most of it's quite a thick river, with the only crossing being the Uzbek-Afghan Friendship Bridge, which, funnily enough, is the same bridge the Soviets used to invade Afghanistan back in the 70s. So Tajikistan is the obvious kind of drug trafficking route into Central Asia. Now, there's been a few approaches. You know, Russia used to patrol this border, but the money to be made was too much too effectively for anyone to walk away from it. It's why one of the reasons why this border service is completely independent from the rest of the armed forces. You know, for someone who's maybe they take a cut to allow heroin through this particular route, they allow this truck through, their privates will get a cut, their officers get a cut, the security service get a cut, and the president is the only one who oversees the security services. We don't want to make full allegations, but we know. The executive will likely get a cut as well. So they are very aware of it. They know, and they do get a cut. The interesting bit, though, is the difference in China and Russia have taken to this issue. You know, China has been very worried about, you know, terrorism coming out of Afghanistan, particularly as Xinjiang and Tibet are, you know, right there in the west of China. So it has seemed to adopt a policy, particularly after the problems in southern Pakistan, of using the Tajiks as a proxy. Effectively, China is experiencing a problem in southern Pakistan at the moment where, you know, they had their own security services guarding some of their facilities. Those security services were obviously being better paid, they had better conditions. Locals got annoyed. Locals attacked the security services. Security services killed locals, upsets the locals, more locals come and attack the Chinese, and you end up in a cycle pretty quickly. They're really struggling to get that under control. So here in Tajikistan, whilst they do have a very small People's Armed Police facility out in the very southeast extremity of the country, down near Kizilrabot, the consensus seems to be that they are paying the Tajiks to do, you know, we're going to pay you a bunch of money, but you're going to put more border patrols on to deal with the border. And the EU is also throwing money at them for that reason. The Russians are throwing money at them for that reason. Which is also interesting because it's throwing money at the branch that is the least accountable to anyone. It's the one that doesn't have any parliamentary oversight, no civilian oversight. It only answers to the security services and the president. And the worst strategy seems to be at the moment, and again, it's very hard. We hear this from people we've interviewed. We've heard this from people in the security services who were willing to kind of give enough of this, but obviously there's no official policy on it. But it seems to be that the Chinese have advocated for Afghans to bring the heroin to the border, but a Tajik will take it from the border into the rest of Central Asia and on to Russia and wherever else it is. So the Chinese seem to have accepted that heroin is going to come through and there's too much money to be made to be able to, you know, not stop it happening. But that if it is a Tajik taking it, there's less chance of radical extremism getting into Xinjiang, which is a really pragmatic, weird way of doing this, but it kind of works, I guess. That seems to be the Chinese strategy here, which has been interesting to watch. The second question was India. India has been a really minor power here in Central Asia. It keeps its foot in the door. And we do see that every time Pakistan and India just kind of flare up a bit, that we do see India kind of re-talk to Tajikistan about opening a base somewhere in India. You know, right now there are two facilities they have. They technically have rights to operate out of Farkhor. They used to during the war in Afghanistan, which is right near the border on the between Tajikistan and Afghanistan. They used to effectively land at Farkhor and then truck stuff into Afghanistan. Today, with Kabul more than functioning as an airport, it's kind of not used, and there's no Indian personnel and no planes sitting at the facility at the moment. They do operate the India Tajikistan Friendship Hospital, which is in Bokhtar, but it's a very small facility and just kind of a bit of an outreach and to keep India's foot in the door. I would be not shocked to see India make more inroads in this region in the next few years, but it's not particularly high up the Indian priority list unless things get worse with Pakistan, in which case it always then does pop up again.
And a follow-up question to this from Fraser. Have you seen any changes on the border since the Taliban have been in power in Afghanistan?
A few. There's, you know, a lot of concern about ISK. I think it's a little bit overblown at times. Some of the reports you read of, you know, where they say, oh, an ISK attack, you know, happened at this village. And then when you actually go speak to people in the village, they tell you it's a drunken farmer on the other side took a couple of pot shots. And it's everyone in this circle is incentivized to ratchet up how bad the attack is. Because obviously, the worse the ISK threat is, the more money that Russia, China, everyone else will throw at the Tajik border service. And the worse that it is, the more money the ISK can try and raise from rich benefactors in the Middle East or particularly in the Gulf. So everyone has an incentive to ratchet up how bad the threat from ISK is. It doesn't mean they're not a threat. They are, you know, have caused a few attacks. There was one quite serious one in 2019 near Rudaki, where effectively they crossed the border and killed a few personnel and came back over. Most of them since then have just been rockets being fired in. We're also seeing this very odd situation between the Taliban and, you know, the government in Dushanbe, because again, the US-supported government in Afghanistan was quite often ethnic Tajiks, so Tajikistan had a very good relationship with them. The one we have now is more ethnic Pashtun, which is, a bit, lack of a better word, closer to what Pakistan is. So the government in Tajikistan has been one of the only Central Asians to really not want to work with the Taliban. Whereas when you look at Uzbekistan, they are gung-ho and making sure that, you know, the Afghans can be worked with, helpful. You see most of, for instance, the expansion of the Afghan rail networks and most of the expansion of their Afghan power networks are all coming in from the Uzbeks. Quite often with Chinese and Russian money, but Uzbeks are the guys kind of spearheading the projects. We also see this weird situation where in the capital, the embassy is still being run by the old administration, but there is a well-established bunch of networks between the Taliban government and in Kabul, or current Taliban government in Kabul and Dushanbe. They're happy to work with each other. They understand even the Afghan mission in Khorog, which is in the very east of the country, in the remote parts, is run by the Taliban. So it's, you know, a very dual kind of world going on. Both sides really don't have massive incentive to change the reality of what it is at the moment. Mostly just because they're already trading. They don't do that. We're not going to exchange too much. Even rail networks, nothing's going to come in through, you know, it's always going to be cheaper on, you know, conventional goods to come in through Uzbekistan, where there's an official border crossing. If I were a betting man, I'd say them two of them are probably just holding out to hopefully that Russia and China might throw enough money at them to get them to play nice. Because right now they have no incentive to change the situation apart from upsetting ethnic Tajiks in their own in Tajikistan and you know, upsetting Pashtuns inside Afghanistan. So on the cards, you know, on the border, not much has changed. In reality, not much has changed. Trade is still pretty minimal outside of, you know, illegal goods and services.
And I'm moving on to please everyone keep putting your questions in the chat. But I'm moving on to a question from James, who is asking do you have any data in your database on the Amrullah Saleh's militia? I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly. He mentions that Saleh is a Tajik Afghan warlord. He's wondering if you have any information on that.
A little bit, not enough that I'd feel comfortable speaking without my notes in front of me, because it's a very niche case. So if you want to, I can get back to you and give you a full rundown on that one. But generally, most of the warlord systems, they're either sitting in Qatar or they're sitting in Dubai pretty happy, or they're actually living in quite nice houses in Dushanbe. We find that most of the conflict along the border with Tajikistan is either with the Kyrgyz along the north. In the south, it is the odd farmer or the odd drug trafficker or just someone taking a pot shot. because it's quite well regulated at the moment. Of not railroad, not officially regulated, but everyone knows which border crossings are there. Everyone has arrangements with the border guards. The drug trade is quite smooth because everyone would rather have this smooth, streamlined. It comes through all these really particular border crossings rather than have a million crossings with people trying to get across, which makes it much harder to monitor terrorism and what's coming in. So there is a bit, you know, if for warlords in the area, there was the Tajik security services found a few copies and leaflets for a publication called The Voice of Khorasan, which definitely upset and worried a few people because it did show that there is an expanding influence of ISK here in the east of the country. But if this is at a big thing, it's debatable, but definitely a sign that things are changing. But most of the warlords from that era are effectively either working for the Tajik government, living quite happily in mansions in Dushanbe, or living somewhere in Dubai these days. But if you want to, I'll write down that person's name and I can message them and give them a full rundown. And I just don't want to speak out of turn and give everyone bad information.
Fair enough. That's really good. I want to ask the next question from Subtle. They're asking, because you mentioned economics and international relations, what is the Tajik economy like? And what other options do people have career-wise beyond working for the border force?
This is the biggest underlying factor. Everything in this will effectively drive every Tajik decision. Tajikistan is the most reliant country in the world on inbound remittances. And to give you an idea of just how tied to Russia they are, Dushanbe is a very small airport. You know, it's 10 flights a day, very, very tiny. And you can go check flight tracker right now. Most days, if there's 10 flights, 8 of them will be going to Russia. There are usually like 3 or 4 daily flights to Moscow because so many and so much of the Tajik population has a brother, a sister, an older sibling, an uncle who works in Russia and sends money home. In 2022, remittances made up 51% of the Tajik economy, which means effectively if Russia changed their visa laws or cut access to Tajik banks, there goes 51% of the Tajik economy just overnight. That is a terrifying position for the government of Dushanbe to be in, because they really cannot, you know, say anything bad to Russia, and Russia can just cut that off. Remittances is the biggest driving factor of their foreign policy, and will haunt them for a very long time. Now, it's gone slightly down since 2022. It's still in the high 40s. Kyrgyzstan is usually in the high 20s, getting to the 30s. In a bad year, it might even get toward the 40s. Uzbekistan's in the mid-20s or high, upper 20s, depending on how the Uzbek economy is doing at the time. Weirdly enough, Kazakhstan's like 1%. They've got a much more robust economy compared to the others. Turkmenistan is a whole other kettle of fish, very low remittances, but they also have 74% of their exports going to China. And it's one product, one company, one everything. So when China changes the price, there's really nothing Turkmenistan can do about it. When it comes to, you know, the Tajik economy, there's an aluminium company called Talco, which is a very big company in Tajikistan comparatively, although they're very tied to the government and has had a few corruption scandals over the years, put it mildly. But if you're not working for the border services, you're not working for the government, you're not, you know, working in a plum position in Talco, it's pretty dire. And it's why you see a huge amount of Tajiks going to Russia to send money back. I cannot stress enough how much the remittances absolutely shapes Tajik foreign policy.
And this economic dependency, if you look at the vulnerability of Tajikistan to external shocks, for example, since the ongoing war in Ukraine and the sanctions following that were put on Russia, what have the economic implications for that been for the country?
So the war in Ukraine and the sanctions on Russia have affected each of the Central Asian countries really differently. For the Tajiks, it was really rough, particularly in 2022, because most of the consumer goods that come in through Tajikistan will come in through the Uzbekistan, or they'll come in through, some through China. But even then, there's only one border crossing into China, and it's very, very remote and very expensive to get stuff in. Almost everything from China will enter through Kyrgyzstan into Uzbekistan and then into Tajikistan. In fact, the rail networks in Tajikistan don't even function going north and south. They are appendages of the Uzbek rail network. So let's say if you want to go from the capital, Dushanbe, to the north of the country, you have to go into Uzbekistan, use the Uzbek rail network, and then go back into Tajikistan, which obviously affects consumer prices for everything. Now, when it came to 2022, the Kyrgyz made a bucket load of money. The Kyrgyz are part of the Eurasian Economic Union, which is, you know, the Pepsi of the EU. I'll just rack on Pepsi for a bit. But effectively, the Kyrgyz probably bought maybe 10 like metal lathes a year from the European Union. Sanctions go on Russia, and all of a sudden they're buying thousands and thousands and thousands of these things. Russia was using Central Asia, particularly Kyrgyzstan, because it had a bit laxer laws than Kazakhstan, to just buy in everything they need and then re-export it back into the Russian market. So Kyrgyzstan made a buttload of money doing that, whether it be from that, whether it be Chinese goods that they're reselling, particularly things like dual use items, so tracking systems, GPS systems, scopes, lasers, all those kind of things that you buy from China, it comes into Kyrgyzstan, Kyrgyzstan slaps 5% on it and then sells it back to Russia. Kazakhstan does this as well, particularly airplane parts. Everyone's wondering why the Russian airplanes haven't fallen out of the sky. There's your answer. Tajikistan isn't part of the Eurasian Economic Union, though. So it didn't get this windfall coming in of effectively being able to slap 5% on top and send it off to Russia. So it suffered quite badly because the price of everything went up. And it was really interesting. I was in Tashkent, which is the capital of Uzbekistan, just before the sanctions came in. And the market, the big Chorsu Bazaar they have in the city there, overflowing. Every bench, every table is full of goods. And then once the sanctions came in, everything became really difficult. It was a running joke with the guys I would go into restaurants with that we would all pick something from the menu and it would see how many times we'd have to, change our order until the guy went, yes, we do have that, no problem. Because Russia has built the system to make these guys reliant on Russian consumer goods for a majority of their stuff, either through subsidies or just for, plain economics. So as a sake of the argument, just to kind of give a real weird example, let's imagine two cans of spaghetti. Russia makes one for $1.50. China makes it for $1. That seems like you go to China, but because Russia is subsidizing all the travel that goes down the Trans-Siberian Railway, and because all the rail networks in Central Asia effectively head back north, it was built by the Soviets, not surprised. By the time it gets on the shelf, the Russian shipping probably added 50 cents to the cost. But for China, who either has to send it into Kazakhstan and then on, or using the Russian rail networks anyway, it's probably $2.50, $2.80 by the time it hits. So the Russians have kind of built this dependency on Russia into the system, particularly for oil, gas, all sorts of exports. So Russia does have a pretty big place in the market here still. And when the sanctions came on, it really did affect the Central Asians quite badly, as well as the weakening Russian ruble, which was a massive problem considering all these guys are so reliant on remittances. So if you're getting paid in rubles, the paycheck you bring home is not only worth less, but anything you buy from a third-party country, so from the EU, from Turkey, from anywhere, just became so much more expensive. So it's been pretty rough for these guys, except for Kazakhstan, who's been able to sort of take advantage of some of the gas sanctions and sell a bit more gas, and Kyrgyzstan, who has just become a massive re-export market for these kind of things. But Uzbek suffered fairly badly. Tajik suffered really, really badly. And it's why 2022, we did get to that 51% remittance mark because there was no work in Tajikistan. Everyone went to Russia to go work. Sorry, it's a very long answer there.
That was good. Very interesting. And I like differentiating a bit between these the roles of these Central Asian countries and how they responded to these external factors differently. Because what would you say is the role of Tajikistan within Central Asia and this region?
So if I was to kind of describe the five for someone who's never thought about it, and doesn't look at these guys very much, out of the five, Kazakhstan is, if they're a family, Kazakhstan is the older brother who left, got an accountant degree, and is now paying for the party for everyone else. They're the richest by a very long margin. They have very large budgets. They have the most diversified economy. They're a state that you tend to find a lot of your multinational companies will be based in. If you're gas, oil, quite often you'll be based in Kazakhstan because they've got massive gas and oil reserves. And they also have done things like they have a legal system for their own population, but are happy to use the British legal system for outside companies to make outside companies feel more comfortable working in the country. Kyrgyzstan is a very small economy. It's a very mountainous place. It's effectively a few cities nestled in among the mountains, very poor, mostly reliant on a very small handful of things like gold mines. And it's a country that had, effectively every couple of years, there's massive public uprising and the president gets overrun and they put a new guy in. I'd say more often that you have presidents who are removed from office by public protest than they are from elections. It'd be about even either way. And it's a country where it used to be the island of democracy in this region and is now really quickly not becoming it. Japatov came to power in a violent struggle and effectively now is punishing the press, shutting down opposition, and making elections more difficult. So we're watching Kyrgyzstan, really quickly descend on the freedom scale, whilst Kazakhstan is actually starting to improve things a little bit. Now we're Tokayev in power. Tajikistan is the smallest and the most different out of all of them. Out of the other four, are all Turkic. They all speak a Turkic native language. They're much more similar to each other, apart from Turkmenistan. It's a bit weird there. They are Turkic, though. Whereas the Tajiks are closer to Iranians. So they're a bit different. It's even, when we look at their drone procurement programs, we see the exact pattern play out there, too, where Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan are all gone to the Turks looking for their drones and building local factories, working with them. But the Tajiks have gone to the Iranians looking for drones and have become quite a large drone manufacturer on behalf of the Iranians. Tajik is definitely the poorest, smallest military. Yeah, I don't want to really say something about their corruption, but it's not great. Uzbekistan is a very large population. It's in the middle of everything. If you want to transit through areas, you probably go through Uzbekistan. It's not unusual if I want to fly into the region on a particular day, I'll fly into Tashkent and go from Tashkent out. But it's all about the valley for them and they've got their own problems. But we'll talk about that when the Uzbek chapter comes in. Turkmenistan is a gas giant. It has as much gas, if not more, than Qatar. But due to the fact that the regime is so insulated is the nicest way I can possibly say this. Put it mildly, they are lower than North Korea on the freedom scale, and they are more repressive than North Korea, which should give people an idea of what the Turkmen administration's like. So you have this kind of Kazakhstan is starting to look elsewhere, starting to breach out to the rest of the world. Kyrgyzstan is losing its democracy very quickly. Uzbekistan is still this kind of central population hub and the center of the whole region. Tajikistan's the very poor kind of oddball. And Turkmenistan is a North Korea and no one wants to talk to them very much. If that's kind of should give you a bit of a snapshot of the region, I guess.
Thank you. I got another question in the chat. Sato, who's looking at the Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan borders. It's making her dizzy. Mm-hmm. How comfortable are they themselves with the different enclave situations, or are they more logical based on geography than it seems?
Not at all. They are awfully drawn. It is the most awful border drawing I've ever seen, and it's classic style in border drawing. To give you an idea of how crazy this can be, if you want to look at the exclave of Sulk, which is, it is an exclave that is ethnically Tajik, but is administered by Uzbekistan, but completely enclosed within Kyrgyzstan. And that should give you an idea of what the Fergana Valley is like. Central Asia, if you kind of look at it from a topographic map, is a huge amount of desert and a huge amount of, unusable desert. A couple of rivers, which are very fertile, and that's where people tend to conglomerate around. And then the Fergana Valley, which is, surrounded by Uzbekistan as the kind of center of it. And around the hills are Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. The Fergana Valley has been the center of huge amounts of problems for years. And it's on the other side of a bunch of mountains from Tashkent. So Tashkent is the capital of Uzbekistan, has 40% of its population over the set of mountains connected by one tunnel. And this valley has three countries competing in it with borders that don't make sense and farmers that continuously ignore them. quite a common thing we see happening, and where a lot of these conflicts between border forces kick off, is a farmer will have a herd of cattle and they're not getting fed enough. He'll walk them across into, who cares? It's the borders don't matter. Walks them over to, pasture, eat grass, technically within Tajikistan or technically within Uzbekistan. The border forces see them. They tell them to leave. The farmer says no. The other border force rock up. And again, these are both independent services who can fire on each other without permission. And that's where skirmishes kick off. So in situations like this year, where we are expecting coal shortages to come up in Kyrgyzstan, we are expecting problems politically to kick off around January. The water levels have been very low in this region, so we're expecting that there's going to be less feed for the animals, that there's going to be more border crossings. And they can't solve this issue really easily because the borders are so badly drawn and all over the shop. There are so many towns where it'll be, to either drive to one Uzbek town or drive to one Tajik town, you'll have to drive through a part of Kyrgyzstan to get it. And when they have problems or nationalism or just trying to, give the people something to look at rather than the coal shortage, they can cut those roads off and it becomes an incident pretty quickly. So the borders here are a nightmare and complicates everything dramatically.
Before you mentioned that you expect India's interest into this region to increase in the coming years, why could you elaborate a bit on why this region is so strategically important for these big powers?
So the region does a few things. One, it has a bunch of really important minerals and refining capacities. Lithium, uranium, gold, copper, you name it, it's in massive amounts. And, I've done a lot of consulting for mining companies over the years, and there's a few things that they tend to look at. If they want to, the way that mining tends to work is when you start a mine, you don't actually make much money at the very start. You expect to put a bunch of capital up front and you lose money for the first sort of maybe 5-6 years. And then you pay off the interest and you pay off the loan. And then the back kind of 15 quite often is where you make your money. So they need to find a place that has cheap and accessible power, has an ability to effectively keep stable transportation networks, and has good resources, an easy way to get it to ports or easy way to transport it around. And the government is unlikely to seize your mine. And Central Asia ticks a lot of those boxes. And as much as there's not as much political freedom as many people would like, Rakhmon in Tajikistan has been in power since 1994. Japarov is new and he seized a mine, and now we're seeing a lot of miners leave Kyrgyzstan. Tokayev came into power in 2019, sorry, after Nazarbayev had been in power since 1992. Berdi Muhammadov, he's the third president since the country's been there, and his father's been in since 2006. Mirziyoyev's been in since 2017, and before him, was in since 1986, 87 off the top of my head. These are very stable governments for mining companies, for resource companies, stable countries, that have built-in Soviet rail systems, that have really fairly stable power grids because they're all built by the Soviets. And they built overcapacity, quite a lot of this. So it is becoming a more attractive resource, destination for a lot of these countries, particularly if you're looking at right now deciding between, hey, I need copper. Do I go to South America where some of these governments get overthrown fairly often? Do I go to Africa where there's problems, quite often with the governments? Do I go to Kazakhstan where everything's fairly stable and they're willing to, respect rule of law? It becomes a fairly, if they had ports, they had access to the sea, they'd be way richer than they are. And as long as you can get around the Russian rail network problem, it's actually a fairly attractive destination for a lot of countries and companies at the moment.
Thank you. I want to say that it's the last 10 minutes of the talk. So please, if you have any questions, put them in the chat now. Talking about all these, this interest from external powers, you mentioned Russia, China, India, the border security programs from the US and the EU. How does a country like Tajikistan or other Central Asian countries manage all these relationships? And what are the risks in balancing all these interests?
It's really interesting. The Russians are very happy to let Tajikistan kind of have lots of these interests and like talk to a lot of people, but there's almost clear boundaries drawn. So for instance, Russia is more than happy to let China invest in the you know, roads, the rail, the tunnels. But the Russians tend to push back when China wants to invest in, let's say, telecommunication systems very much. They tend to push back when China wants to get more involved with security than they kind of are. So we are seeing a bit of great power push. Not to say these guys don't think for themselves. You know, it's been really interesting to watch, you know, particularly over the last few years, that these guys are starting to reach out to more players. I think it was just this week that Uzbekistan's just come back from, I think it was Dubai. I can't remember which country it was. I won't say just in case, but with the deal to set up a massive grocery chain across the country to help, you know, get away from some of the old Russian chains that have been problems in the market for a while. We are starting to see, you know, particularly in Uzbek and Kazakh, a slight opening of the door and looking for more partners and players. That doesn't mean the Russians' role in the security services and the military will change, but it does mean that culturally there are big changes happening on the ground at the moment. And a lot of this is just due to fixed costs. You know, if you, you know, let's say, you know, I hear this quite often, why do they get Abrams tanks, you know, from the Americans? They're better tanks. And I would 100% agree that American Abrams tank is better than a Russian T-72. But the, you know, these guys are mostly deciding for the military between, you know, do I spend $20 million on an Abrams tank and then I have to pay new mechanics, new parts, new equipment, new everything. And I have to have a whole new chain of supply for this one tank. Or do I just get a, you know, $50,000 modernization kit from Russia and I slap it on and I extend the life of this vehicle by another 5 years? Now, because the fixed cost is already paid. You know, Russia paid it back in 1964. The tank still technically functions. We're not going to be invaded anytime soon. And you can see why there's an easy preference on, do I spend $25 million to buy a US tank? Do I slap $50,000 into this and I have a Russian tank still for a war? I'm probably not going to have to fight very often. So there is this kind of built-in fixed cost problem that, you know, we are still going to see Russia really, really embedded in security and military. But the other one, particularly Uzbek and Kazakh, are starting to move away culturally, economically. And China, Turkey, all the India, Dubai, all these guys are starting to play much bigger roles in the region going forward.
And for the last section of this talk, I want to go back into the open source angle that we've already briefly touched upon. But it sounds like there's plenty to going on in the region to research. And I was wondering, how do you envision the database and the report to be used by open source researchers working on Central Asia?
This would be a big part of this is to effectively be able to, A, use the military knowledge and the security services to try and fix some of the problem in the reportings that we see all the time. So, you know, it's interesting when you read the, you know, the primary source stuff in Tajik language, and it will give you the branch that, you know, that they are being accused of torturing. So, for instance, there are quite a lot of torture reports coming out of Horog, out of Roshan, out of, you know, down in the Central Valley. But when I see Western publications reporting it, they tend to get, you know, they say, oh, it's part of the military, which it's not. It's part of the security services. You know, the hope is that people can, A, have a kind of charts, resources to understand, okay, here's the distinction, here's how they break up, here's how to, you know, differentiate one from other, and here's where each one sits. You know, if let's say you were to say, hey, there was a incident, you know, a mass shooting or something in Roshan, I would go, oh, well, Roshan, the base there is, you know, run by this branch and it's by this unit. Let's see if we can go find anything we can on that unit. In which case, you rather than just trying to type Roshan army troops, you can go Roshan unit 02011, and it will give you a way better search on what you're trying to find. It cuts out, much like what the OSM tool does with you guys, it's just rather than going into this scattergun and just trying to find something, you can limit it down to a really narrow set of things you're looking for. You know, most of the geolocation work's already done. You can also get an idea on what the aims and what either of these guys are. Part of this is also things like, you know, having the camouflage patterns and be able to go, okay, well, that parade is ground forces because their camouflage looks like this, or that one's, okay, this is an MVD parade because they're wearing this part of this pattern on their camouflage. It just makes any work you do in this region a whole much easier to go and look at and go, okay, I know what I'm looking at. It makes sense. And here's most of the kind of preliminary information you need to find beforehand. Because these areas are going to be in the front line of anything ISKP for a while. IS. This is one of the areas they're going to try and probably make a lot of effort to expand into. And it's going to be more important for trade and foreign influence going forward. Again, this is the Tajikistan in particular has the largest Russian base outside of the Federation. And it was one of the things I know Russia analysts were looking that, you know, if the Russians were willing to pull stuff off of the 201st in Tajikistan, that was a massive sign that they were having problems with their attacks. You know, that they needed to pull stuff off here was a big sign to a lot of people that internally Russia was panicking, and keeping an eye on the 201st and watching those numbers drop was a big sign of things that were happening elsewhere in the Russian military. It's also, you know, if you're looking, Russia is quite, occasionally pretty good at finding keeping some of their numbers quite quiet. You know, how many tanks they're making, how much they're charging. But these guys in Central Asia are usually pretty rubbish at it. They often just accidentally publish stuff or put it in sheds or don't put anything inside. So you can actually get a pretty good idea by getting numbers from, Tajikistan or how long and how quickly things get repaired. Because again, it's an interesting, I'm on a tangent here, but the Russians, well, particularly the Uzbeks, are a best example where they actually can't repair most of their jets or aircraft themselves. So they end up having to send away to Belarus mostly to get anything fixed. And it gives you a really good idea of how long those jets are and when they come back, because they've all got tail numbers and they all pretty regularly do stuff. So we can know that, hey, Jet 64 came away and it was away for way longer than it usually is. Okay, Belarus must be a bit, flat out repairing stuff at the moment. And you can kind of track how long things are to get there and back again. It's a security backdoor, I guess, for Russia, if you're a Russia analyst. But to me, I think it's just a fascinating region on its own.
What challenges did you encounter researching this, like, military sensitive material using open source?
Huge amount. Huge amounts of problems. I mean, one of the major reasons we had to do this is because we had to, tap local networks. We had to go down and meet people. We had to, effectively convince people who were either defected or people to hand us documents that we shouldn't have. Either way, it was a lot of on the ground research because there is very little to go off. If you want to, let's say look at the Australian military, you want to look at the Canadian military, you want to look at most of the Europeans, there have been a gazillion defense studies already done, or Jane's has got something, or Bellingcat's done great work. And you have a really good starting position to go. Whereas coming into Central Asia was almost a blank slate. We had to effectively go and look at mostly old Soviet reports to find bases originally. And try and find, like, okay, there was a motor rifle regiment here. Let's find out what is here now. There is very little been done, particularly in the last decade. The last proper study was probably about 2005, 2010. And it would have been done by the US, who were looking at, using Central Asia as kind of a middle ground for operations in Afghanistan. So that was a big problem, is just the lack of information you find in this place.
Well, and you're contributing greatly to that. And I think we should end the recording here because we're almost at the hour. I want to thank you for your impressive work and for your amazing resource that we've hopefully introduced our server and researchers to. For hopefully many further investigations into this region. Thank you, everyone, for your questions. I'm going to end the recording here. The recording will appear on all of your favorite streaming platforms in the coming days, as always. And in 2 weeks, we will be back with a new episode.
Again, thank you so much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. If anyone has any questions on Central Asia, I am always happy to answer them. If people are asking me questions, then my wife has to hear me ramble about Tajikistan even more. So, you're saving my wife by getting me to give you answers rather than my wife. So feel free to, you can Google the reports and my emails in the very back of that. You can always email me there at my Oxus stuff. Otherwise, I'm pretty easy to find on Twitter at MikeElliottOz as well. You can always just DM me questions and always happy to talk Central Asia with anyone interested.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Stage Talk. If you'd like to catch a Stage Talk live, where you can ask the guests questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.